From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, wiggling out of the more than $9 billion in business tax credits, why that's not the solution for the state's budget deficit.
All of a sudden, people have gotten kind of intoxicated with the idea that, hey, we can just walk away from things. They did it in the Detroit bankruptcy.
Why we should ditch our old curriculum-driven method of teaching.
We live and breathe within this curriculum-driven model because it's all we know.
Saving President Grant's Detroit house again?
Pitching this story, people were like, Grant lived here? Wait, his house still exists?
Should the Lions have cracked open the piggy bank to keep Sue in Detroit?
And this is one of these utterly irrational sports budget debates. Is he worth it? No, nobody is.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It is no secret that our education system needs massive improvement. So what's the holdup?
We live and breathe within this curriculum-driven model because it's all we know.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, making the switch from curriculum-based to competency-based learning. But first, when Governor Rick Snyder was answering your questions earlier this week here on Michigan Radio, he waded into the issue of more than $9 billion in outstanding tax credits owed to businesses who stayed put in Michigan and reinvested in their operations here. And that has tipped Michigan's budget into an unplanned deficit. The program began in the Engler administration, but then was widely used in the latter part of the Granholm administration. Critics are calling it corporate welfare. To that, the governor said,
we still have this legacy of the tax credits, and I wouldn't use the term corporate welfare. Again, these are our job creators.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been sniffing out ideas some of our state lawmakers are floating to try to cure this so-called tax credit hangover. Daniel, you're calling these ideas a faulty prescription. I get the sense from the column you wrote you're rather incensed.
I don't know if I'd say incensed, but I think people need to think this stuff through. I mean, I think we've gone through this period of bankruptcy and everything in Detroit, in the state, and all of a sudden people have gotten kind of intoxicated with the idea that, hey, we can just walk away from things. They did it in the Detroit bankruptcy. Well, yeah, but they did it in the context of federal bankruptcy. States can't go bankrupt under federal law. And the reality is these are contracts, primarily with the big three automakers, and they delivered. They invested billions of dollars in plants and in office expansions in the state of Michigan and got these credits for them and added the jobs. And now the state has got to give them the credits that they are obliged to give them. And people are screaming bloody murder and saying, we can get out of this. I've been getting emails saying, oh, you can. It was done in bankruptcy. Why can't it be done here? One person called it ridiculous that I would suggest that they would actually have to pay them.
And in your column this week, you actually pointed to State Representative Brandon Dillon, Democrat from Grand Rapids, who's like, well, everybody has to make concessions just like state employees have done and firefighters and so on and so forth. And your point is?
Well, my point is they didn't get nothing for it. The state didn't get nothing, and I hate to use bad language, but that's exactly basically it. You know, they got something for these tax credits, and it was investment. And this whole notion that, well, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler wouldn't have walked away, or the government wouldn't have let them walk away in the context of the bailout, well, Ford wasn't a party to the bailout. And the truth of the matter is that what they were able to get coming out of the recession and the kind of lowered break-even points that all three companies got made investing in Michigan possible, as did the credits. And in fact, I got an email after I wrote this column saying to me by a very high-ranking executive at one of the car companies, you're exactly right. That helped us to put a small car project into one of our plants in Michigan than we otherwise would have made overseas.
In fact, you do a pretty neat three-part breakdown on the three main things you think Michigan got in exchange for these business tax credits. So take us there.
They got jobs. Mm-hmm. They got investment. They got sales tax revenue. And they got income tax revenue.
Yeah,
it's more than three. And, you know, all of which I think are very important. And I would add another one, and that is that essentially you have a greater concentration of the U.S. auto industry here in Michigan than you've had in any time in a very long time. Now, there are people out there who will say that's a bad thing. But these companies have a very different financial structure and a very different ability to compete, both in the United States and around the world. They're making more money in the U.S. than they've made in any of our life, well, going back to the 60s probably. But into the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, their business model in the United States was upside down. And that ultimately culminated in what we went through in 2008-09 and early 2010. Mm-hmm. That business model is now different, and the problems that they're having financially, to the extent they're having them, are not in the United States. They're overseas.
And you do have worries. If you see lawmakers in Lansing trying to renege and walk back from what was a deal, you've got some worries about the long-range effect on future investment in Michigan.
Well, what does this say about Michigan? Is you cut a deal with Michigan, and if there's a political backlash or if the price becomes too large because things change, they're going to want to back out. I mean, I've been critical of the film incentive program, but that's another example. I mean, under the previous administration, they created a film incentive program that was very aggressive, that became the most popular in the country. And as soon as Governor Snyder came in and said, you know, I'm not too crazy about this, and he changed the metrics, that so-called industry left like in a week. And all of a sudden, Michigan got the reputation that, you know, they're just going to change on a dime. And a lot of this is driven by domestic politics here and also the budget situation. And people tend to overreact and look for ways to bail out. And I think what you've also found here is a lot of the new legislators do not quite understand how these tax credits work. They view them as, or consider them to be something, the state's cutting the companies a check out of the box, which they're not. The companies have to deliver on their commitments before they can claim the credits. And that's why they're now coming home to roost, because they have delivered on those commitments, and now they're taking their credits through their tax returns.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
You know, you'd have to try pretty hard to miss all the headlines and all the buzz surrounding Michigan's head football coach, Jim Harbaugh. After the disappointing decade for Michigan football and its fans, Harbaugh rode into Ann Arbor to great acclaim, and that's putting it mildly. And as we're about to hear from Michigan radio sports commentator John Eubacon, Harbaugh's motto, "Hungry dogs hunt best," really was born way back at the start of his time at U of M. John, tell us how things got off to a very bumpy start with Harbaugh's first team meeting
Bo. You got to remember that Jim, of course, basically grew up in Ann Arbor 7 years, from about 4th grade to 11th, 10th grade or so. He's the ball boy for the team. So Bo has known Jim since he was 9 or 10. His dad, Jack, was the defensive backs coach for Bo for those 7 years. Jim is like a son, basically, to Bo. However, when you show up 5 minutes late for your first team meeting, it really doesn't matter too much. And Bo's famous quote to him is, "You will never play it down at Michigan." Now, keep in mind, the seniors have been hearing this stuff for 4 years. They knew it was a bluff. Jim didn't, so he was never late again and ends up being the Big Ten MVP. But I can also guarantee it's not a good idea to show up late for his meetings now either. He is almost the reincarnation of Bo himself.
Well, I love your phrase. You say weapons-grade discipline is back in town.
Oh, yeah. Weapons-grade indeed. This guy is a jackhammer. One of his great quotes is, "I don't get sick. I don't observe major holidays. I am a jackhammer." It's like, I tend to believe it. These guys get up at 5:45 in the morning. They meet in the hotel lobby of a 3-star hotel here in town. They eat some oatmeal. They go into the office. They go to midnight. They carpool back. They get up and they do it again.
Wow. Wondering, how has recruiting gone since signing day for both Harbaugh and D'Antonio?
Very well on both fronts. Now, they're after, I think, different kinds of guys, so the overlap is not as much as you might think. D'Antonio knows exactly what works well for him, and it's worked very well for him. So some overlap, of course. Everyone wants the top dogs, but hard to tell right now because there aren't that many commitments coming in this time of year. Mm. But Jim basically only had a month to recruit his first recruiting season. They're fixing that now. So D'Antonio, Urban Meyer, and Jim Harbaugh, the Midwest will be very carefully gone over.
Let's pivot over to basketball. We've got the Big Ten Men's Basketball Championship underway in Chicago. What do you see for Michigan playing Illinois today?
Playing for their lives and not their NCAA lives. That ship has sailed. By the time this thing runs, of course, we will know who won that game. They've got to win that game. If they win that game, they're playing Wisconsin next. That is no bargain.
Ooh.
Wisconsin is the top team in the Big Ten, one of the top teams in the nation. They have to win that game, too, probably to get an NIT bid, not NCAA, but National Invitational Tournament, which is the leftovers, basically. And even that is going to be a stretch for Michigan.
And Michigan State's playing, we don't know yet, on
They're a whole
Friday.
Lot happier.
They got the third seed.
They got the bye. They're the third seed in the Big Ten tournament. They will likely be playing Ohio State in their first game, assuming the Buckeyes advance. They could still lose that game and still make the NCAA tournament. They'd like to win as many as possible because the more you win, the higher your seed, the easier your opponents are as you enter the tournament. But this is not one of Tom's best teams.
Yeah, it's been a struggle. It has been a struggle. But you have said—
Putty and paint, man.
body in pain. But you said you totally see them getting that 18th bid on Selection Sunday.
I don't imagine a scenario where they can't get it.
Okay. And we'll just recap again. You've said it often. Michigan's ship has sailed for the NCAA, and they're hoping for the NIT. What do you see a year from now for Michigan?
Watch out, because almost everybody's coming back. Caris LeVert, their one star on the team, might be coming back as well. That is not clear yet. But everyone else is coming back. They will have a very seasoned, experienced team. And Beilein can flat-out coach. In some ways, D'Antonio, Michigan State football, and Beilein, Michigan basketball, are very similar.
How
they,
so?
They take 2- and 3-star players, not the 4- and 5-star players. They coach them up, and within a couple of years, guess what? You are now ready for the pros. And that's been the problem in both cases. They are ready for the pros, and they go.
Finally, a few thoughts on the Lions with Sue headed to Miami. Should they have cracked open the piggy bank to keep him?
It would have been a $27 million piggy bank, and this is one of these utterly irrational sports budget debates you get going. Is he worth it? No, nobody is. The flip side is he worth it to your franchise? Very tough call. Many people think that he was because he's a straw that stirs the drink on defense. Everyone becomes better. You got to avoid the guy and so on. The fact is you will not know the answer until we talk about a year from now.
But I did hear, I think it was someone on ESPN saying, hey, 6 years with the Lions, what have they done?
True also. No playoff victories.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, they've got a smart bunch at the front office at the Lions right now. And for $27 million, you can get 3 or 4 other very good players. So it might work out very well for them.
And we're seeing probably looking like Nick Fairley is headed out of Detroit as well. But he's been battling weight and injury problems. So how do you see the Lions plugging those holes? And do you think that trade for Ngata with the Ravens, do you think that'll help?
Well, when John Harbaugh, the Ravens coach and Jim's brother, sings his praises as a great player and a better person, you take that seriously. I think John Harbaugh is a very good judge of character. So I'm sure he will help the Lions, no question about it. The question is, will he help the Lions that much? I still maintain it's on Stafford more than anybody. Matt Stafford, the quarterback, he is a good to very good quarterback. He is not yet elite himself. He has got a losing record against winning teams on the road. That can't last.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubakin. Thanks, John.
Sandy, always a pleasure.
Coming up next, it is here tomorrow. Who's afraid of Friday the 13th? And then the magic and the moods of Tango Nuevo. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Superstitious folks just might want to break out an extra rabbit's foot tomorrow. For the second straight month, there is a Friday the 13th. Now, for some of us, the day may summon fun memories of bad horror movies, but for others, it can be a day of fear, real or imagined. In fact, there is a nearly unpronounceable word to describe this fear of Friday the 13th, parascaviticatriophobia, I hope. Joining us right now from the other side of Lake Erie is Professor Phillips Stevens of the University at Buffalo. His research includes topics such as cultural anthropology and religion and magic and magical thinking. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, first of all, let's cut to the chase. How do you pronounce the word that describes the fear of Friday the 13th?
I have no idea. In fact, that's the first I've heard of it. Triskaidekaphobia is a word that I finally mastered, and that one means fear of 13. Now, this word that you've been trying to get out includes Friday, and my classical Greek is nil, so I just can't do it.
Tell us this. Why is it Friday the 13th has such a negative reputation, particularly in the Western world?
The number 13 has been a taboo number for over what is probably 2 millennia now. It seems to originate in the story of the Last Supper of Jesus. There were 13 people at that table, and the 13th was Judas, depending on how you count them, who betrayed Jesus, and the next day was the crucifixion. That meal, that Seder meal, took place on a Thursday, and the next day was the most terrible event in the life of Jesus and in the life of his followers, and people put those two things together. This is an example of a taboo, an act to be avoided because somehow participating in it might bring about an unfortunate consequence similar to what was originally being commemorated. This is an example of magical thinking based on principles of similarity. Things or actions that are similar to other things or actions are universally believed to have causal relationship. You can make things happen by acting them out. And this is a universal belief, absolutely universal. And similarly, you can make unfortunate things happen by acting them out. And so this kind of taboo involves the active avoidance of establishing a magical connection.
That's why we will never see the 13th floor in a high-rise elevator, will we?
And in many airlines, the 13th row, although I have seen some 13, and much to my surprise, in recent years, the taboo seems to be dying. But no Washington area hostess, at least earlier in the 20th century, would seat 13 at a table. That was an absolute taboo, directly derived from the story of the Last Supper.
Interesting.
It seems folklorists are pretty well agreed that all of the superstition about 13 comes from that Christian story.
So does the superstition, Professor, hold more in the Western world than in the Eastern world?
It is very widespread, even beyond Christian areas, because certain things, Malcolm Gladwell called them memes, you know, certain ideas spread kind of on their own. And since the brain is wired for magical thinking, this one would spread by itself, even separate from Christianity.
And Professor, it's interesting, you use that term magical thinking and not the more commonly used word superstition. And you say there's a very fine difference between those two concepts.
What we call superstitions are mostly, nearly all, are examples of magical thinking. But I tell my students that we should avoid labeling them as superstition because the word itself implies that the user has a better explanation, that the one to whom the label is applied is somehow lesser in thinking, in intellect. Superstitio, to stand above, is the direct Latin root of this word. And, you know, it's a downer. It's putting someone down, really.
Yes.
And so anthropologically, it's not really an acceptable word. That's all. Maybe I'm nitpicking. But magical thinking, as I said, is universal. It's based on two basic principles, although there are others, the principles of similarity and principles of contact. Things that resemble other things have a causal relationship. Things that have been in contact, direct physical contact with other things, have a stronger relationship, even when they're separated. And these ways of thinking are absolutely universal, and it suggests that the brain is prone to that kind of thinking.
Interesting. And truly, it seems like the way that people who are uneasy about Friday the 13th, the only thing to do is really get through it. There's nothing you're going to be able to do to make that unease go away.
Right. And some of these so-called superstitions may actually be beneficial, like walking under a ladder or that kind of thing, because they cause people to avoid risky situations, you know, and be more careful about what they're doing. And this one is pretty harmless, and it's part of our folklore. As you said in your introduction, we have two of them in a row this year, which is unusual. And it offers us, people like me, a chance to expound a little bit about human nature. And I think it's one of those interesting distractions that we really cherish in our lives, you know?
An interesting look at magic and magical thinking as we look at Friday the 13th. Philip Stevens is a professor of anthropology at the University at Buffalo in New York. And we want to thank you so much for your time. And, Professor, we certainly hope that your Friday the 13th is as absolutely uneventful as possible.
And enjoyable. And it's getting warmer. The snow is melting.
We'll take that, too. That is some good stuff. Professor, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. That is the voice of Miguel Angelo singing with the Oblivion Project. This group is dedicated to performing the music of Astor Piazzolla. He's the late Argentine composer who's regarded as the godfather of Tango Nuevo. The group's appearing throughout the Midwest, and that includes a performance in Ann Arbor this coming Saturday night, March 14th. Vocalist and dancer Miguel Angelo is with us now, born in Venezuela and now based in Brooklyn. Welcome to the program, Miguel.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited. Thank you.
And we want to welcome Derek Snyder, cellist and band leader and originally from Ann Arbor. Hello, Derek.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Tell us, Derek, what is Tango Nuevo and how does it compare to traditional or old school tango music?
Yeah, well, I actually just read a neat quote about Piazzolla's music having the eyes and the nose and the mouth of the tango, but the rest being Piazzolla. And what Piazzolla did was he expanded upon kind of the tonal exploration of tango and made it more concert music. So it's not stuff that's as predictable to dance. It expands and goes in a lot more directions than traditional dance tango. You can certainly choreograph his music, but putting it on, you know, for a dance class is a little tougher.
And Derek, now Piazzolla is no longer with us, is he?
Piazzolla died in 1992, but this week marks the 94th birthday of Astor Piazzolla. He had a stroke in 1990 and died 2 years later. But this is the celebration of his birth, and we do a week of shows every year at this time.
And was he celebrated in his lifetime for the work he was doing in creating Tango Nuevo and making it what it is, or is it the kind of a thing that has come as years have passed, appreciation has grown?
He was celebrated, but he was also controversial. There were many people who said his music is not tango, kind of in the way that some of Stravinsky's music got people very passionate. So he was very popular around the world. He was more popular outside of Argentina for his music during his lifetime. He had more success outside, and I think that was a little tough for him. He was a little resentful of that, but he's recognized kind of universally now as just being an incredibly prolific and creative composer.
Can you tell us about Liber Tango?
Liber Tango was written in a period where Piazzolla was living in Italy, and he wrote an album of bunch of these tangos. Liber Tango was one of them, just meaning free tango, and it was meant to for the performers just to feel totally released and free to kind of create. It was one of his most popular pieces, although he did not play it much by himself in concert.
With Derek Snyder and with Miguel Angelo. They are with the Oblivion Project, the group dedicated to performing the Tango Nuevo music of Astor Piazzolla of Argentina, the late composer, regarded really as the godfather of Tango Nuevo. And there is, of course, the music, and then there is the dance. And Miguel, you do both. What's the feeling? I mean, each form of music and dance is expressing something. What do you feel that Tango Nuevo is expressing? What are you saying when you're singing and you're dancing?
Well, you know, I was a dancer back in Venezuela. I did ballet dancing from 15 years. And besides that, I was doing musical theater there. So Piazzolla music, the lyrics, they are so deep. They are so beautiful, like poetical. So for me, it's really, really easy when I listen to music and then I translate the movement of dance, contemporary dance or ballet dancing to the stage. And, you know, especially when some people, you know, that they don't speak the language, the Spanish, it's kind of magic. They understand, even with the movement that I do, they understand what I'm trying to say or what a Piazzolla trying to say with the song. So it's really magical for me.
Very universal. Derek, yeah. You grew up in Ann Arbor. I'm wondering, when did you first encounter tango and then Tango Nuevo?
I was in undergrad, cello performance at Western Illinois University, and we took a trip to hear Mstislav Rostropovich perform in Chicago, and he played a piece that was written by Piazzolla for him, the Grand Tango. That piece really hit me, and immediately that's what I remembered. And this group formed probably about 10 years later. We've been doing shows now for a little over a decade, but because of the prolific output of Piazzolla, there was so much to explore, and we've been, you know, just delving into the 3,000 pieces.
3,000 pieces. You know, there is, you probably know this, a significant and enthusiastic tango community in Southeast Michigan, especially in Ann Arbor. And I'm wondering, what is that like to go around the nation and kind of sample the way different areas appreciate Nuevo Tango?
We've had, it's very common after our shows that we have people come up to us from Argentina and just say how much they connected with the performances and how authentic to them it felt, which is a great feeling. Until recently, our kind of cast of band members has not included people from Latin America. So that's been a nice to feel that the way we are presenting the music is coming across in a kind of authentic and a way that emotionally connects with audiences.
Hey, Derek, I'm wondering, what is the significance of the group's name, The Oblivion Project? What's that mean?
That was just named after one of his pieces, Oblivion, which is maybe his, next to Libertango, that might be his most famous piece. And interestingly, it's a piece that he never recorded, but it was written for a soundtrack to a movie.
I'm wondering, what have you seen as far as you explore this music and Tango Nuevo? How has that changed your musical view of the world?
Well, one of the things that Piazzolla did was he blended in his musicians from different backgrounds. He had musicians from classically kind of trained backgrounds. He had people from jazz backgrounds. He blended actual instruments that weren't always used together, like jazz guitars with violin, with bandoneon, kind of creating new sounds out of blending those. And we have been kind of blending those instruments along with musicians from different cultures and backgrounds. We have someone from Venezuela, from Costa Rica, from Cuba, from Texas, from Ann Arbor. So blending these kind of backgrounds from, you know, all over the world, it just brings more flavor to the music, which Piazzolla lived in four different countries. And each of these countries you can hear in his music, he is drawing from those cultures.
The Oblivion Project will be performing this coming Saturday, March 14th. They'll be at the Carytown Concert House in Ann Arbor. And you can actually get tickets and find out more information by going to their website, OblivionProject.com. Miguel Angelo and Derek Snyder, it was a pleasure to talk with you and to catch your love of Tango Nuevo and the music of Astor Piazzolla. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. And we always love to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on and what issues do you want to hear more about? Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the oldest structures in Detroit is going to be moved. But this house built in 1837 isn't just any house. It's where Ulysses S. Grant lived. Dan Austin's with the Detroit Free Press and historicdetroit.org. Hello, Dan.
We meet again.
We do, and we're talking about another architectural treasure in Detroit. And before we talk about how you actually physically move a house that dates back to 1837, tell us a little about this house.
So this is a house that was built over near where Lafayette Park is today. It was kind of almost on the fringes of Detroit of 1837. Grant was a young Army officer. He was fresh out of West Point, and they transferred him to be the regimental quartermaster at the Detroit Barracks in the spring of 1849, and he needed some digs. And it just so happened this house at that time was nearby, and so he moved in. And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like this is a house that is incredibly important to the legacy of Ulysses S. Grant. I mean, he lived there for only a year.
But he lived there.
But he lived there.
And he brought his wife, too, didn't he?
And he brought his wife, yeah. And she apparently was big into the garden that this house had. It had all sorts of fruits and veggies and things. And so, yeah, it's like a footnote in the Grant story, but it is, we can say that Grant is the only president who had the pleasure of calling himself a Detroiter.
That's true, because our other president who lived in Michigan was Gerald Ford, but he had the pleasure of saying he was from the West Side.
Yeah, Grand Rapids. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't know about this small piece of Detroit history. They don't know that Grant ever lived here. And when I was pitching this story, people were like, Grant lived here? Wait, his house still exists? It's where?
There you go.
So, I mean, it's one of those things that the house, for a long time, was quite the attraction up at the state fairgrounds.
Because we should say it got moved, didn't it,
from
that Lafayette Park area up to Peyton Woodward.
Right. In 1936, when this house was going to be leveled for an industrial building, a president of Michigan Mutual Liability Company was a big war buff, and he got the building moved up to the fairgrounds to present it to the state of Michigan as a gift for all people in Michigan to enjoy. So you, me, all of our listeners own this house.
Interesting.
And so now, with the state fairgrounds being shut down and them developing, putting Meyer and all those other places up there, Magic Johnson wanting to develop there, they have to find a new place to put this house.
So here we are talking about moving it again, but moving it in 2015 with traffic and freeways the way they are now is a whole lot different than when they made that move in the 1930s. So what are the challenges to get this house to where its new home will be?
There's nothing that's going to be easy about this. I mean, really, the details have not been finalized on this, but they're looking at two possibilities. One, they take it on surface streets, which will be farther to do because you have to kind of go around the freeways, and they'll have to lift up the traffic lights and street lights and everything else all along the way. Possibility two would be taking it on the freeways, but to do so, they would have to slice the house in half, which nobody wants to do. Apparently, this stuff is done not all the time, but fairly often, and they're confident they could do it with keeping the house intact, but, I mean, the house is nearly 180 years old. Clearly, you know, trying to put a house that old back together again would add some more headaches. So we're not sure exactly how they're going to do it, but the fact that the house has gone from point A to point B, and now it's going back to point A, basically. So we'll see what happens, but it's a really exciting moment of preservation in Detroit. You know, our city, at least until the last couple of years, has not been known for really caring about its past. You know, we've demolished so much of our history here. Here's a piece that we're going to go out of our way. We're going to jump through the hoops and move to save it for future generations.
Dan Austin is with the Detroit Free Press and historicdetroit.org. Dan, as always, thank you so much.
Till next time.
Challenge. Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education is not a mechanical system. It's a human system. It's about people.
It isn't a secret by any stretch that our education system needs some massive improvements, both here in Michigan and nationwide. American students are lagging considerably behind many of their international peers on numerous academic measurements. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea believes at the heart of this is our reliance on this one-size-fits-all, curriculum-driven teaching model, a model that dates back to the mid-1800s. Bob Sorensen is founder and president of the Early Learning Foundation, based in Brighton. He's an author, a speaker, and a former Michigan school administrator. Good to have you with us, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Why is this curriculum-based method of teaching not cutting it for us in 2015?
It is an approach that we've been using for more than 150 years. It's based on the premise that we will teach a certain set of content in each given year and then move forward in a progression. Over the last 30 or 40 years, we've put that system on steroids by adding more content and asking teachers to teach more, faster, and very often to younger and younger students. In a system like this, it's invariable that some kids come into a course in which there is so much content being presented so quickly, more prepared than other kids. But it's likely that a whole bunch of kids in that class are not fully understanding, appreciating, and learning at a rate that is important for kids to be able to love learning, be involved in their own learning, and to think of themselves as good learners.
Hmm. Your essay for The Next Idea, Bob Sorensen, takes us right back to the root of this system we're using, and I was so startled to realize we go all the way back to the mid-1800s to Prussia.
Yes, indeed. A gentleman by the name of Horace Mann was the first secretary for the State Board of Education in Massachusetts, the first public education system in this country. And he was sent to Europe to do a little scouting around and look at all of the different educational models and systems that were available in Europe at that time. And in doing so, he picked the Prussian system, which, in his opinion, was one of the least punitive systems of the time, came back and instituted a grade 1 through 8 system, not intending for all students to follow through all 8 grades, but to get a whole lot of kids to have a little bit of information in the areas of reading and math and ethics and discipline and a set of skills like that, knowing that very few would finish all 8 grades and very few would need or want to go on to high school or any kind of advanced learning beyond that.
And in 1855, that worked.
That's absolutely right.
You didn't need to, you know, to build a life by going on and taking higher education.
By 1900, the high school graduation rate in this country was 6.4%, using the same basic model that Horace Mann had instituted. 6.4% was more than enough people in those days to finish high school and maybe be thinking about doing advanced study beyond that. We did not need advanced thinkers, readers, mathematicians, and scientists in the same way that we do today.
Well, in your essay for The Next Idea, you're arguing we need to move away from this one-size-fits-all curriculum-based model to what you call a competency-based model, much like the approach we take when we train doctors or pilots or just about any career that requires skill mastery. So what would this look like in the classroom?
We live within a model. We live and breathe within this curriculum-driven model because it's all we know. Except it's really not all we know, because every parent I know knows how to present a competency-based learning model. When you're teaching your child to ride a bike, you don't use a scripted program or a pacing guide. You don't make sure that he is using a tricycle one week and then training wheels the next week, and then you take off training wheels the following week. We wouldn't do that to our kids. We give them all the time they need at every different stage in the development of those skills and the love of using those skills while riding a bike. I think that's kind of part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
To be able to fully develop those skills. Did you ever train a teenager or help a teenager learn to drive a car?
Mm-hmm. We did.
Did you rush it, or did you take all the time to build the skills so that this child and maybe the rest of the world would be safe?
We took the time it took, and of course the state helps us by setting that time where we know that we have to be with them for all those hours. So yeah, we had lots and lots of hours.
Competency, it's all around us. I was in an airplane the other day. I'm really hoping that the Delta airplane pilot had a competency-based training program and not just a coverage-based training program, because I don't want the C-minus pilot. I want the one who has every skill, completely competent, something I can demonstrate and use in a whole variety of different circumstances. I can land that plane on a good day, on a rainy day, on a windy day.
Yep, just like a surgeon. I want a competency-based surgeon if I'm going to be on his operating table or her operating table.
And in fact, in pretty much every area that we've decided is crucial in our lives, we have competency-based training programs, technical training programs to become a master-level electrician. You learn the skills, you learn the information, you practice the skills, you build the skills, you demonstrate the skills, and then you become a master.
You cite some examples in your essay, Bob, of where this approach has had some success. At the state level, New Hampshire has made some important changes. What have they done there?
New Hampshire's been a real leader here. They started at the high school level by establishing competencies for each of what were the high school course requirements for graduation. So they said, let's just not pass this course and get a B or a C or a D. Instead, let's establish a set of competencies as a framework and have kids actually show that they have these skills before graduation. The State Board of Education established a structure, gave permission to do this, and then made it a requirement for every district in the state to come up with a set of competencies that would match the state requirements for graduation. And they're in various stages of implementation. And then their hope is to someday remove the course requirement altogether and simply have a competency set as the expectations for graduation, and then gradually build down into the lower grades. In a different district up in Alaska, the Chugach School District in Alaska, they did it somewhat differently. They looked at their situation, which was unique. You know, more than 20,000 square miles of space and about 220 students. And so they had a certain set of circumstances, but they also had low rates of graduation and relatively poor educational outcomes. They say, we need to consider doing something different. So they established a competency framework with 8 primary domains for graduation and a set of skills that they want as outcomes. And then they started to create a chain or a pathway backwards to those skills that needed to be in place at all of the different levels preceding graduation.
It sounds like if we were to take this and put this into Michigan's classrooms, it could place a very, very heavy burden on classroom teachers who have to, attend each student's learning progress individually. And how do you keep this from being overly burdensome on teachers and on schools?
We are used to, in the education business, these long lists of typically called grade-level content expectations, now these days more often called Common Core State Standards, long lists of things to cover. We've been racing through lists of things to cover for a very long time now. It's kind of what we think we do. A competency framework is going to look very different than that. A competency framework has to be very clear, very specific. It has to be a very short list by comparison to these very, very long lists of things to cover, because coverage and competency are two very different things. So by creating a very specific set of outcomes and helping teachers get each child to those outcomes in their own way, in their own time. There's a guy in New Hampshire, John Bramante, he uses the phrase, anytime, anywhere, any pace. We're going to get you to these outcomes, and you can learn it anywhere, anytime, at an any pace, but to help you get to these outcomes is our goal.
And can we expect Michigan's teachers to reverse course, learn these new approaches as they're still trying to meet the standards that exist with probably ever larger classrooms?
Well, I can tell you from my own experience that this is a significant change for teachers, because I work with districts in Michigan and Mississippi and around the country, helping them try to learn how to do this. And it's a different frame of reference. In some respects, the old curriculum-driven system is easier. It's my job in a curriculum-driven system to come in and teach this lesson today. I'll try to do a really good job. Good, responsible teachers plan ahead and prepare and think about it. How can I present this lesson in the best possible way? Hope that I get a lot of kids to learn a fair amount of this, or maybe even all of this, but then know that the school expects me the next day to move on to the next lesson and the next lesson and the next lesson. So learning to transfer from that model and that way of thinking to a competency-based approach is going to be a significant restructuring of the training needs of teachers, the systems of support within school districts. It is a different mission to help every kid get there in their own time, in their own way. Think of this from the equity perspective. Poor kids in general come into school with lower levels of oral language skills, very often less preparation, less experience with literacy, very often less preparation, less experience with mathematics. if we want to give poor kids an opportunity to be successful in this country, a one-size-fits-all curriculum-driven system will not get it done. It's killing those kids at rates that are well-reported that we really understand.
Where do we start in Michigan if we want to move toward this competency-based framework? Where do we begin?
It's pretty simple. We start at one end or the other, or maybe we start at both. We could start at the graduation end, like New Hampshire is doing, create a structure for those outcomes that we think are really important for kids to have by the time they get out there in the real world and are prepared for a real world of work. That could include college. It could include other kinds of vocational and technical training. It could include military. It could include all kinds of things. So we could start at that end, the high school graduation end, and build a system back downwards. Or we could also start, as I do in the work that I do, with establishing the foundation of early learning skills in all of the domains of learning, things like oral language, things like sensory motor skills, things like early literacy, including phonologic skills and all the other aspects, things like early numeracy, things like the social skills and especially the self-regulation skills, the capacity to control yourself, be calm, be focused, persist, delay gratification, those things that are incredibly connected to predicting which kids are going to be successful in learning but also successful socially.
How optimistic are you that Michigan would move and will move in this direction?
It will. The question is, how long will it take? Ultimately, other countries around the world are moving quickly, more quickly than we are, in some of these directions. And the countries that position themselves best by having the best educational system and preparing more kids to truly be world ready. I mean world ready, because we're competing around the world these days.
Bob Sorensen is the founder and the president of the Early Learning Foundation based in Brighton. And you can find his essay on the Next Idea page. Just go to michiganradio.org. And please share your thoughts and views in the comments section below Bob's essay, or go to Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or as always on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. Bob, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Our contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.